what's wrong with this thing? I think it's busted.
Busted. Busted.
What's going on? Ladies, gentlemen, those beyond the binary, poets, perverts, explorers of all kinds, hucksters and schmucksters, knuck if you bucksters, welcome to Bust a Mouth at Q4 Radio, a show about rock and roll, sticking it to the man, and your big stupid feelings, streaming around the world every single Monday, mostly, from 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. on Apple Radio, the TuneIn app, 1680 a.m., that's 1680 a.m. in Chicago, and of course, QUE4.org. Shots. I'm JW Basilla, your host as always. Happy Monday. I hope it's going well for you. You deserve it. I realize there are new listeners to the show, and some of you don't understand why I yell shots. I basically spell. That's what I do. I spell words just to make it a little bit so I understand how the words, because it's a visual thing and it sticks in my brain. I don't know. I spell things. I used to spell way too much, and every time I did it, I just would make a joke about, hey, take a shot at home, blah, 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 and then it turned into what it turned into. Great. Off to a terrific start. Stephanie Douglas, my friend, a hilarious human and storyteller extraordinaire, is going to be in studio today. She's my guest in the 1 o'clock hour. I'm looking forward to sitting down with her. I have all kinds of stuff going on this week that I can't unpack for you at the moment. I cannot. There are too many things going on, but hopefully, if you stick around, you'll find out some stuff. How are you? You okay? You doing your thing? You got to keep doing what you can do. You got to keep moving forward. You just keep your head down. Baby steps. Baby steps is what I'm trying to say to you. There's so many things I want to say that I cannot say on radio right now, like things that just came to me in the last 20 minutes that I cannot say on radio right now. Anyway, baby steps. We're all doing our best to get better. If that ain't the theme of my whole life right now, Dr. Leo Marvin. You know what? Let's get up into some feelings after the break. Let's do that. But first, rock and roll, shall we? How about that new Beach Bunny? Man, I played these cats on one of the first episodes of the show almost 3 years ago, and or 2 years ago, however many years ago we started this thing, a number of years ago, and they're blowing up all over the place. Good for them. This is Beach Bunny.
Promises and problems were all left inside, buried away at the back of my bed. Close my eyes, but every time I try to rise, you start to think clearly, you live inside my head.
Focused, dude. I have a lot on my brain today. I just have a lot on my brain today. I know you're thinking, hey, Bass, why is that? That's every week. And I'm like, I know, but just specific things. It's not just a lot of things. It's very specific things right now. And it all happened in the last hour. So things are happening. I don't know. Maybe we'll have some updates. That's cool. Good for you. But there are all kinds of feelings. I had some feelings yesterday and some the day before, and I will have some again tomorrow. Feelings exist if you pay attention to them. But since we are talking about big stupid feelings and living inside that world, and I have a feeling that the Stephanie Douglas interview is either going to go completely silly or completely dark, and I have no idea which one it's going to be, but we're going to find out. But while we're in the feelings realm, I want to focus a little bit on something specific, and that thing is empathy. Yes, the big empathy. We've talked about it a lot recently. I've been thinking about it a lot recently, doing work on it. Alyssa Thorderson, when she was in, we got into it a little bit, and I was thinking about it a lot over the last few days. And as the tides would have it, I just got my letters back from some high school friends. That's not creepy. It sounds creepy, but it isn't. The high school pen pals of sorts that I have with the Diversity Dialogue Project that I think I mentioned a while back. The project, for those of you that missed it or didn't hear me talk about it, the project was started by my homie Tom Bidet, who's a dope teacher and a very dope human being. And in essence, adults around the country get paired up with his students to share letters and ideas. And one of the letters in particular that I read yesterday really hit me, and I felt compelled to respond like right away, almost immediately. Like I read it, And then I pulled up my laptop and I just started writing in response. And specifically, the young man mentioned, I'm not going to read the letter to you, but he did say, you've probably noticed that I'm not a very empathic person. And then he also asked me if I thought that empathy could build people up. So I laid in bed for like an hour and just drafted this long letter in response and realized that I was really just kind of figuring it out as I went along. I've been using writing recently to organize thoughts, as opposed to like I'm using writing to specifically express something or to push something down the field or whatever it is. I'm actually just kind of using writing as a way of organizing thoughts lately, which is something I did a lot when I was younger, but now I'm just in that game. Anyway, here is a chunk of my response to him, and it may change. It may not even go to him, but it's a thing I wrote. So here it is. Honestly, it seems disingenuous and easy to write yourself off as not empathic. You are empathic. I can feel it in your writing, and I know by simple biology that empathy exists inside of you. I just think you haven't noticed it yet. And really, that's what empathy is. It's paying attention. Just as you all talked in class about the infinite connection of all living things, how seemingly tiny interplay between species can alter an entire ecosystem, every human being you've ever seen is equally infinite. It's easy for anxiety to screw up your entire sense of focus. You know how you feel when you walk face first through a massive cobweb? In that moment, the cobweb sticking to your face is the sole focus of your entire world. Sure, you have homework to do, and people are dying of hunger every day, and you're really looking forward to spring break, but none of that matters right now. In this moment, you have a stickety, disquieting nightmare all over you, and unless you're being chased also by a rabid dog, the only imperative your brain can process is, get this thing off of me, it's all over me, it's all over me, and that's anxiety. It's a big, sticky thing that cannot kill you, taking over your entire world by forcing you to focus on yourself and yourself alone. In that moment, there is no one else that matters. There is just you and a cobweb. And when I was 30-ish years old, I started, seeing a therapist for the first time in my life. And we worked on anxiety and mindfulness and used meditation, all the things that you'd expect. And what I noticed is that nothing we worked on actually solved anything. And sure, I felt more calm, but the anxiety was still there, and my problems didn't go away, nominally. Then, one day, while mindlessly scrolling through Facebook, I saw a post from a friend of mine about the fundamental vastness of all people. In that moment, a rush of peace swept over me, and my brain launched into pyrotechnics. Vast. V-A-S-T. Shots. Vast. It's the perfect word. Human beings are vast. Sahara vast. Yellowstone vast. Bonneville's salt flats vast. In the same way I am a collection of likes and dislikes, memories and opinions and experiences, talents and dreams, so too was everyone else. So too is everyone else. And I just started noticing it. The woman who was not paying attention and missed the green turn arrow, so I called her an idiot out the window. Vast. My own mother, who I've known for my entire life but somehow know nothing about on a human level. Vast. The guy at work or school you just can't stand and you hope you never get paired up with. Vast. All of the mindfulness and anxiety didn't fix any of my problems, but it just made it possible to notice things. When I started noticing other people as vast beings and not as someone in the way or someone I was annoyed to make small talk with at a party, everything got easier. The cobweb got off my face. And last night, this is true, last night I went with my partner to an art opening in her coworker's converted apartment, which was acting as a DIY gallery. Now, whereas most galleries have high ceilings and a large floor plan, this was an apartment, a brick and hardwood Chicago 2 flat with no furniture. It was loud, a cacophony of people laughing and talking over each other, and I knew no one there except for my partner and a couple of her work friends that I'd only once shared small talk with at some other gathering, probably like this one, and I stood there, straining to hear the name shouted at me as I was introduced to a litany of people, and my only thought was, how much longer do I have to stay here? I hate meeting people. And I meet dozens of people every week. A lot of people do. Most people do. In my line of work, I meet more than the average. And I'm uncomfortable every single time. Even if they seem perfectly lovely, even if I'm not feeling self-conscious, even in a perfect, wonderful environment, I just don't really like meeting people. I just don't. At some point during this party, I retreated to the kitchen and I was introduced to another coworker, a specifically eccentric woman whose first sentences to me were, I'm really excited to meet you, and are you really the misanthrope that my partner says you are? My partner being Renee. So setting aside the fact that my partner apparently tells everyone she knows that I hate people, I was struck by the question, and I had to unpack it kind of as I answered. Am I a misanthrope? I don't know. I don't think so. I just find people trying, I guess, and I understand the inherent vastness of all humans. I'm just not that interested in getting to know people, is what I said, and that was a lie. I was sure that was a lie. As I said it, I knew it was a lie, but I stood there working to decipher this quite blunt and challenging human across from me, and I realized that while I don't like the act of meeting people, I really like getting to know people. Meeting people is all about the me, right? Me thinking of polite ways to express myself, me answering questions about the least interesting parts of myself, me feeling awkward and feeling dumb, me. Unless you get my attention right away, I get frustrated by having to have a forced interaction with someone that likely won't last long enough to get to the good part, the digging in and discovering their vastness. And I don't always like what I find. A lot of people, no matter how far I dig, just don't interest or excite me, but I like the expedition of finding out. And this doesn't always work. Sometimes I can't get past the cobwebs long enough to care very much about other people at all, even the ones I love. And I wish that was different. I'm taking baby steps to try to make that different. So it goes. You try again tomorrow. Sometimes I just outright dislike people. We all know that. Some days I leave the house and find a reason to be a hater to every single person I pass on the street. They're taking too much of the sidewalk. They're talking too loud on their phone. They spent $6 on a stupid cup of coffee with a dome lid and whipped cream. And I hate to admit it, but these days are probably more common than the ones where I leave the house making a point of being peaceful and decent. But if I can stop myself, though, if I can find some small crack where the light gets through, and I can start to look at every person on this overcrowded subway as a vast, vast biome trying to get by, everything, and I mean everything, gets easier. So you asked about my thoughts on empathy and whether it can build people up. So I'll summarize with this. Empathy isn't looking at someone suffering and saying, I know that sucks, because it would suck if it happened to me. Empathy is more about saying, I acknowledge that you're suffering, or joyous, and I feel for you because my fundamental humanity acknowledges yours. Does that make sense? Can empathy build people up? Dude, sometimes I think it's the only thing that can. Good tunes. Oh, there's a baby making all kinds of noise in this studio, and I'm kind of digging it. She's a cute one. She's just learning things. See, this is what's going. This is what my life has become. This is what everyone's life become. You listen to Busted Mouth on Q4 Radio, QE4.org. Shots. Listen, streaming around the world, Apple Radio, the TuneIn app, etc. 1680 AM in Chicago. I'm JW Bacillo, your host. As always, saying my own name even sounds like a chore right now. But more importantly, I have a guest in studio who is a storyteller, a writer, a performer, a producer, an organizer, a mom, an urban farmer, does all kinds of stuff. Multi-hyphenate white lady in the building right now. That's Stephanie Douglas. Say hi, Stephanie.
Hey.
What's going on?
Oh, you know, we are just enjoying this lovely rainy day.
And I'm looking forward to it.
Right, yeah. I'm trying to teach my kid to do an impression of the Count from Sesame Street.
Yeah, well, if you don't actually have words, you could... She's getting pretty good at it.
She's nailing it.
She's getting pretty good at it. It's weird as hell that you're in the studio with a baby right now.
Right.
And not because we haven't had other people bring kids into here, but just because it's you.
Yeah, it's me.
You trash mouth heathen, you.
It's terrible. We were very afraid of what some of her first words were going to be, but luckily we've managed to curb those. So.
Are you the we don't curse around the baby type?
No, we are the once she actually fully understands English, we'll adjust our language, but right now it's totally fine.
So how do you feel about that? Because like my reach over children is very slight, and I think by design. But like when I work with when I'm with my nieces. Like, I try to instill in them, there's no such thing as a bad word. There's right. words that are appropriate and words that are inappropriate, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know.
How are people going to react to the word you use, so helping them understand that. But My brother and sister-in-law figured out something great, which is kids only repeat swear words if it's the last word they hear and you kind of freak out or yep. everybody gives it.
Sure.
So what our family started doing is after somebody accidentally swears, which happens every maybe 7 to 10 minutes, mm-hmm. you just yell something else really fun. And they came up with taco, taco, taco. And so then everybody yells that. And then the kids get so excited and they run around dancing and screaming taco, taco, taco because all right. the adults just said that excitedly.
Right.
And it completely erases anything that happened before yeah. from their memories.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was thinking about like my relationship to cursing, which is a good one. I use the F word like a comma, or I'm better about it than I used to be. Like I used to be just an absolute garbage
yeah.
mouth.
And then, I heard you say a couple things the other night and you went like 7 words without any F-bomb.
Yeah.
So.
Thank you. I don't do it very often. I don't do it as much anymore. And I think a lot of it is that I'm older and a little more detached from the person I once was. I'm a better human being than I have been since you've known me, I think. It's probably the best version, I guess, maybe. But also doing this show and mm-hmm. having to censor myself like
yep.
has made it a little more. Like I've realized how much I use profanity as a crutch, especially for humor.
Yeah, I think working in education, too, I constantly had to adjust what mm-hmm. what I said. And every once in a while, you know, you'd slip up without realizing it, and you'd just see a room full of students look at you like, Miss Douglas,
right?
What did you say? And I'm like, what? What? I said yeah. your homework. And they're like, that's not the word you use. So like,
yeah, I remember like a whole room, I said damn once, and they were like, it's like, okay, first of all, you're 8th grade. You're all 8th grade. Like, you're trash. Like, most of you are 6 feet tall. Like, knock it off. Cut the crap. Anyway, what's this baby's name?
Her name is Ollie Mae. That's her nickname. So, yeah, her first name is Olive Merriam, but so we go with Ollie Mae.
You're not my second friend to have a baby in the last 5 years named the child Olive.
Really?
How strange is that?
Whoa,
like, old school names are coming back again.
Yeah.
Like,
it's just, you know, Joe, my partner, he years ago interviewed this, like, old school punk dude up in, I think, Minneapolis. And this is like, you know, 15 years ago or something, mm-hmm. long before we ever met. And I guess this dude had a kid named Olive, and he was like, that's a cool name.
Sure.
And we could not agree on any names because I liked awesome names, and he thought things like Steven and David were great, which are
your
great
names,
but also my brother's names. And I'm like, we're not going in that way. And he was like, well, I've always really liked Olive. And so we got this short list because we were like, we don't know what the kid's going to be. We want to meet them first. But we met this kid, and it was like, of all the names on the list, right? You were like within 2 days. I mean, pretty much immediately we met her, and we thought, but we're like, let's wait 2 days and see. So the hospital was kind of annoyed with us.
Yeah.
They were like, just pick a name. And we're like, we're meeting our kid first. You know, just let us get to know. And then we were pretty much like, she's Olive. She's an Olive.
That's cool.
You're an Olive.
You're an Olive.
Totally. Yeah. Wow.
Oh my god, this is the worst radio. But it's cute. Like I can't deal with it. Like I'm not a kid person, but I'm also like, kids are so good. I like babies. Like I admit it. I can't do anything.
Yeah,
you're
just like, oh man, it's like a little cute face with two eyes, and their brains are learning all sorts of wild things, like how to not be a terrible person.
Yeah. And then you get to take it home because I'm not interested.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, you're not taking her tonight?
Nope, not at all.
Whoa.
Never will. Never
Sorry,
will.
Kid.
There's one thing you can say. You
Uncle Baz
you
is off duty.
Never spend the night at Uncle Baz's house. Well, I'm not saying whatever. You know what I mean. If you needed me to watch a kid,
there was an emergency.
Of course, I would watch your kid. I've watched kids before, but I'm also like, just as long as I don't legally have any binding.
Right.
To this
nothing.
Child.
Yeah. Nothing yeah. required.
That's important. I mean, it's weird. Like when you start coming up, and we've known each other for a while. Like
yeah.
probably better part of 10 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, at first it was a real bummer, like when your friends got day jobs. You're like, oh, look at you.
Come on.
Paying bills, you yeah. loser. You right. know, and then, like, then your friends just start.
David Mamet said, if you have another thing you can rely on, you're just going to do it, man.
Yep.
Now you're.
Welcome to my life.
Yeah.
as I contemplate taking another management job. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a thing, but now it's like, oh, everyone's just got babies.
Yeah. But, like, I don't know. I think for us, like one of the things that I said going into it was like, I'm like, we're just going to keep doing all the same things we do. And if something feels terrible, we'll stop doing it. But otherwise, we're just going to live our lives like we did, making mm-hmm. sure we're, you know, fully attentive to the little human who gets to live with us. But if something's terrible, we stop doing it. And that's that. And we just figured out. And I was like, you know, people say everything changes, which is true. Also, nothing changes.
Yeah.
Like nothing changes. All the things change, but like nothing does.
How so?
So, like, I think, you know, you're still going through your same, you're going to work, you're doing
sure.
shows, you're having the people who annoyed you before still annoy you, you know, the people who you loved before, you still love, but, like, now you're just bringing a diaper bag while you go through all of those things,
right.
Or if you are breastfeeding, you're pumping when you go through all
sure.
those things. So, but I think a lot of things, it's like, I'm still, you know, producing all the same shows, I adjusted how I did it. I got way better at time management.
Of course.
Still not great, but got way better.
Sure.
You know, and you just kind of keep doing it, and you just do everything a little bit terribly.
But I think you're making the effort, which is good. I mean, I've known some folks who are just like, I've got kids, and now I no longer curse, and I no longer walk outside, or I don't, you know, I don't watch R-rated movies anymore. I don't go to shows. I don't do anything. And they just, like, their whole lives become, I'm now a, my job is now dad, not person I am, but also dad.
Yeah, which know? I think is also, it depends on the person and their needs, and also your kid and their needs. And it's terrifying. Like, I'll say, you know, previous to this, I would have described myself as not generally an anxious person.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm just like, oh.
Really?
Like, everything. You see death around every possible corner.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Constantly. And it's a whole different way of looking at the world. Now, you know, I had that in my head for, again, you know, working in education for years and taking students on lobbying trips to D.C., but it was teen students, you know?
Yep.
So I would look for death around every corner in a different way.
Of course, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you see this, and then you're like, there's this person. And then all of a sudden you're like, if something happens to me, what happens? Oh, my God. So, you know, you do see the world differently. And so I also understand people who are like, I'm going to back away from everything else for a little while.
I get that.
Yeah. For me, it was just, I was like, you know what? I think if I back away from everything, it's going to be not as great for me. So I'm just going to strap her on. And she's been, I mean, last night I, you know, did a show on stage while I was like nursing her because it was right in the middle. And I was like, I'm either going to spray milk everywhere or she's going to stay
on
me.
Wait a minute, you were on stage actively nursing a child?
Yeah, I was on stage actively nursing a child.
All right. Of all the things, I've seen you do some wild stuff on stage. That's high up there.
And
I mean, there's nothing wrong with it.
Right. No, there's a lot of things wrong with it.
But you understand that is atypical to a typical show experience.
It is, but I'm saying, you know what? People drink on stage all the time. And this time it was just a tiny person drinking on stage.
Fair enough. You know? Fair enough.
But yeah, I know. I said she's been to 20 shows, like 20 some shows. And that's the first time that's had to happen, though, you know. And it was just like one of those points because, you know, you stop too soon, there's milk everywhere, or you have a screaming baby in the audience. And I was like, you know what? She can't really hear the mic when she's on there because it's me on it. So she was a little, you know, kind of curious looking up, like you're talking louder than normally and you're not singing to me. But,
sure.
But other than that, it was pretty chill.
Is she going to be one of those babies that you take to like Pitchfork and has big headphones on?
Yeah, I'm hoping.
I'm hoping. Talking about.
Yeah.
Like, this is a big occurrence.
I've got a number of
friends that do that with their kids, and I'm just curious. It's like my folks wouldn't have done that.
Oh, yeah, no way.
First of all, they wouldn't have protected my ears, obviously.
No, they wouldn't have. They're like, you would have been fine. You put the cigarette in your ear.
Yeah,
you
shut
know?
Up.
You'll
yeah.
be okay.
Shut up.
You know, like my parents didn't really, you know, go to live concerts and things like that, so they didn't do that. But I do remember, I mean, we were constantly at my dad's office from a young age, and he would just leave us in the back storeroom, you know, which instantly the floor was hot lava. We would have all of the legal files, like the lower drawers pulled out so we could walk on them and avoid the lava.
Yep.
And then those old water cooler bottles, you'd have to climb from one to the other. And then, you know, he'd come and he'd have to spend an hour cleaning up after us at the end of the day. But it was like free babysitting by file cabinets and some Cremora, which was an old school coffee creamer that felt really fun to run your hands through. Oh, God, I feel so bad for his partners.
Oh, yeah, my dad worked in a factory, and he had an office in the factory, and occasionally he'd be like, oh, yeah, I'm just going to hang out at dad's factory. It was a pretzel factory, so it was kind of like, oh, cool, can I eat those? Nope. So I'm just going to sit around and watch snacks all day? Sounds cool. Yeah. Just watching snacks go by, just being a fat kid, like nothing.
And I've still never eaten a pretzel.
And I'm never going to. I'm going to Arizona in a couple days to go to spring training with my dad and whatever else. We go every year, and it's cool. So I've been thinking a lot about, like, especially with you and the child here, I'm thinking a lot about, like, parentals and parenthood and, like, how you grow and develop as people. And, you know, you and your partner are a little older, you know, for first-time parents, that's not a bad thing, but you've had, like, years of discovering and learning who you are as people before replicating.
Yeah.
So I imagine you're probably going to deal with things a little more rationally than a younger parent might.
I mean, I think in some ways, and also it was one of those things where, like, right before she was born, I was like, we need a financial advisor, and we probably need life insurance, because, like, one of us may not, you know, make it all the way. And, like, I'm like, I mean, they call, I think, anything over 35, they refer to as a, quote, geriatric pregnancy.
Yeah. You're a geriatric pregnancy.
Yeah, which I thought was hilarious. And our midwife was like, no, that's not, you know, we don't use the term here. And I was like, please use that, because that's very fun.
Because you old as
Yeah, because I am. And then my partner is even older. But yeah, so So it was something, you know, we thought a lot about and looked at, and we're like, okay, we have a lot of people we trust. We have, you know, good family unit. And and while we both work for nonprofits, and that's, you know, not always the best financially, both of our places at least have an automatic life insurance. So we're like, well, if we keep working, at least if something happens, there'll be like some cushion, and then, you know, we'll do the rest of the thing to make sure that whoever has to take care of her, hopefully that'll never be the case, but whoever has to, you know, wouldn't have a wild burden put upon them.
Sure, I get that. I mean, my dad was like a beer drinking trash mouth, whatever. And then I don't remember this, but one of the first early stories that was so funny to everybody was like during the Bears Super Bowl, when they won the Super Bowl, and this would have been January of '86. I apparently cursed in celebration with my father while watching somebody run, right? Then I immediately got my mouth washed out as like a 2-year-old.
What?
You know, like they used to do the soap thing.
Yeah, that was so messed up.
Which is horribly torturous. Yeah. Like it's a bad thing.
I still can't touch bar soap.
Yeah. Well, no, my parents used to do the hand soap. So they would take the hand soap, put it in their hands, and then like rub it into your tongue. And I'm like, I'm 2 and I'm clearly repeating something I've heard. This is not me cognitively cursing. This is obviously repeating.
Right.
And it's like, oh, good. We're going to make sure that you don't repeat our mistakes.
You don't. And they're like, you're like, I have no idea what it was related to that I'm getting soaped up for now.
Yeah, exactly. And that's it. Like,
it was celebration that I got soaped up for. I'll never celebrate again.
Right. Like, I think the story goes, my dad yells like, oh, look at him go. And I was like, yeah, look at the son of a bitch go, right? Because clearly not something that I was saying cognitively.
Right. Not the thing you learned at nursery school.
Right. Obviously repeating. So it's just like, oh, and they think this is like a hilarious story. And I go, you know, that's not a cool story.
Yeah.
Like, it's not funny.
No, it's not. Right. Yeah. It is amazing. Like, one of my brothers and I just always talk about, you know, you'll tell some stories from your childhood sometimes, and you're almost telling them like they're normal and it's a sort of funny story. And then you'll realize that everyone around you is going,
no, that's horrific.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, and people will be like, I'm sorry. And you're like, no, but you know, this happened and it's hilarious. And they're like, no.
No.
That's not okay.
No, that's called drama.
Yeah, and then you suddenly start realizing, like, wait, maybe that's not okay. And nothing makes you realize what's probably not okay quite as much as being a parent, because you're just like, the things you would never think of doing to a tiny human that you cared about, and you're like, they just did that? Like, my partner's mother is constantly like, I guess it's bad to smoke now, but, you know, we did it. I did it through all 5 of my kids, and all my friends did it, and blah, blah. Like, and we're like, we understand that you did that, but that's what she says when she comes over after she has smoked, and we're like, you can't do that, man. Like,
you can't what?
Can't come, like, hold the baby after you've just had a cigarette. You
Why
know,
not?
We're like, because that smoke is just all up on you.
But, I mean, the smell, but, like, you think... You think so, really?
Yeah, no, it's not even... That's science thinks so. That's, like, the scientists, like, the, you know, there's, like, the second hand, the third hand smoke now. They talk about when it's in the walls and... Yeah, I'm like, if it makes me cough, like, what's it going to do to those little lungs?
I don't know how I feel about that. I haven't thought about it. Like, my grandmother smoked, which is probably why I ended up smoking. Not why I ended up smoking, but, like, it definitely contributed to me smoking.
Yeah.
Because I started smoking really young.
Oh, yeah, you were, like, what, 11?
Yeah, I was 11 years old. Well, it was more just because my folks didn't pay attention to me. So just like, I got to do something.
You got to get that soap taste out of my mouth.
I got to get this Jergens soft soap out of my mouth somehow.
Because it's still pink.
Let me get these reds going here. Shoot, we've just been talking about this baby so much, like we haven't even gotten into it. What was the first record you ever bought with your own money?
Oh, the first. Did it have to be on vinyl?
No. Okay. Just first album.
Okay,
you bought
first
with your own money.
Album. Okay, first album. I ever bought with my own money. Well, so there were 2 that I bought at the same time, and that was followed by 2 more, and these were pretty much encompassed my taste at that time. So there was the full album, Salt and Peppa's Black's Magic.
Okay.
Was the first, and it was cassette tape.
And
obviously,
you were,
so I bought that.
What age?
I was, let's see, I'm picturing what house we were living in. So I think I was in sixth grade. At that point.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So that's like, what, like 11 or so?
Okay.
I was like 11.
Okay.
And that was like with my own money, like not that I made for. And yeah, so I got that. And also, right around that same time, and I just can't remember if it was on the same trip we got it early, we got the single of Sir Mix-a-Lot.
Ah.
I Like Big Butts. And that one, we had had to like, it was a lot of begging because there was, you know, parental advisory sticker. And then pretty soon after that, it was Guns N' Roses. I believe I got Use Your Illusion 2
first.
Like, I know I bought them out of order. So I'm pretty sure I got Use Your Illusion 2 first, and then I got Appetite for Destruction a little bit later. Gotcha. So that was
okay.
Yeah,
same boat, same ballpark.
Yeah. What about you? What
oh, I've said this a million times. Well, no, I say it.
Say it with us. It is,
yeah. No, take a shot. No, it was Motley Crue's Dr. Feelgood.
Oh. Yeah. Because I remember, like, when my best friend's dad, he would drive us home from day camp, and he was huge into, like, Aerosmith, mm-hmm. Def Leppard, Motley Crue, and Black Sabbath. So we got, like, that whole education there. But it was like I didn't realize that those were tapes that I could buy.
Sure.
Because I was like, that's what we listened to in Robbie's car. Yeah, yeah. You know, that's our... And I remember having this long argument with my best friend where I was like, about... He played Big Ten Inch, Aerosmith's Big Ten Inch, mm-hmm. and I'm like... Do you know what this is about? And she's like, it's a record. It's a record. It's a record of the band that plays the blues. And she was so mad at me.
It's a 10-inch. No, yeah, it's a 10-inch record.
It's a 10-inch record. And she would not believe. And I was like, no. I was like this little evil, you know, 10-year-old, like, guess what this is?
I mean,
and
she's
like,
yes, uh-uh. But also.
But also. Like,
and then you don't understand how, like, a double entendre works. And so, no. Well, it was like when I was in middle school, Primus had Winona's Big Brown Beaver.
Oh, yeah.
You remember this tune
came out.
And it's like, oh, yeah.
Because that one I feel like I didn't figure out until a little, like, yeah, it was like a little later. But I guess that came out a little later also, so.
Yeah.
Like that was, yeah.
And you learn about that entendre. Like, I, within the span of like 2 years, I think we went from Winona's Big Brown Beaver to, you know, like Big Johnson shirts and co-ed naked shirts.
Oh, yeah.
Like all
and
kinds
and
of
Bear Whiz Beer.
That one I've never seen.
Well, I think that might have been like an East Coast one. It was just constantly a bear peeing in this neon stream, and it would be like, you know, Bear Whiz Beer, and then have some kind of like, you know, Big Johnson pun, or you know, whatever. And but yeah, we were big Bear Whiz Beer fans. That was the one we were allowed to get because we were not allowed to get Big Johnson shirts.
I remember buying a Big Johnson shirt and my mother making me take it back to the store.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, and it was just kind of like, okay, I'm just learning that a penis is a thing.
Yes.
Like
that, you know? And it's a thing that people talk about.
Right.
And
so let's deal with this in the most reactive way possible. Because we can't talk about the body.
Just nope.
Because you're a healthcare professional.
Yeah,
we can't talk about it.
Do not use the correct words out loud.
Yeah. And that was the thing. Is like my mom was a healthcare professional. I'm like, why did we never talk about anything in this? Whatever. Like, anyway, nope. different strokes,
make
different
it a
folks.
Diamond.
Yeah, my
make
parents,
it a diamond.
Right, making a diamond.
Different strokes, different folks. Big Johnson.
Big
Johnson.
Hey. Well done. All right. So you, we just did a show together. We just did the Story Club show.
Yeah.
And Story Club is a show that started in Chicago, and there are now multiple.
Yeah, it
there's
is.
Now, like, my buddy Ken Green runs Boston, I think.
Oh, nice.
And
yeah, there's a Boston one. There's two in Ohio. There's a couple in some southern states. There was one in Eastern Europe for a brief time. I'm not sure if it still exists.
Everyone was executed.
Yeah, if you had ever... It was in the Stalinist years, huh? But yeah. So if anyone's interested in running a Story Club wherever they are, that can happen. But yeah, Dana Norris started it about almost 11 years ago. She was writing and she was in grad school and she would go to all these open mics and want to share stories and everybody was like, no, we just want to hear mediocre poems or we want you to like do a guitar thing. And she's like, well,
I feel like you're taking shots at me
poetry.
Right now. I feel
no,
like you're coming directly.
You're a great poet. No, you're not. Come on. Not
no,
you.
I know.
Hey, present company excluded.
No, thanks. No, I'm sorry.
No, but you know, like those are like the open mics kind of just like coffee house, little like awesome, right? They're awesome, kid. So one of her professors, she was complaining about it and her professor was like, well, why don't you just do your own? And Dana's like, what? And she's like, yeah, why don't you just stop complaining and make your own?
Mm-hmm.
And so Dana said, okay. And she kind of set it up in the back room of Uncommon Ground. And we were improvisers at that point and I knew her, but I was like, I made it once or twice to Story Club, but didn't know too much, you know, about it and would stay in touch with her over the years. But years later, I was working in Ethiopia and I got some crazy mystery illness and I came back and I was having memory issues and I was like, I don't feel comfortable performing, you know, doing improv, all these things anymore. And then
because you couldn't memorize the lines.
Yeah, because I couldn't remember. No, it was like just one of those things where I'm like, eh, I'm going to like forget some callback. I'm not going to be on it, you know, and I'm going to say something weird and in the not fun way.
Yep.
And so then, you know, one of my friends was like, well, you should check out this storytelling thing. And I was like, well, stories, like, I know what happened to me. You know, I know things that happened to me, so I can definitely tell those. And I went to what was then a show that Jana Sobel ran called Here's the Story.
Yeah.
And
she's been in. She was in.
She's
yeah.
Right.
We hadn't spoken in a couple of years. And then I was like, do you want to just come by? Like, do you still live in the city? I don't even know. Yeah. crazy,
she
right?
She does. She's a wonderful human. Yeah, and she runs the show, our show very similar called Here's Chicago Now. But at that point, I went to it. I told it was great. And then I went to Tell It the Moth. And then I won a Moth Slam and then kind of went on from there. And it was like, I was just like, oh, this is kind of cool. And eventually, you know, the health issues disappeared and that was great. And I was like, oh, but I kind of still more into storytelling than theater and improv right now. And it works more with my life because of what I was doing with farming. And, you know, I wouldn't have to schedule rehearsals. So, yeah, I kind of just stuck with it. And now, you know, Dana moved and eventually the person who took over for her moved. And she was like, would you want to run a story club? And I was like, yeah, I definitely would. So
it's a, I mean, it's a fun show. It's definitely, it's definitely a lower stakes kind of show, which is great. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but I mean, like, sometimes
it doesn't matter.
No. What I mean is a lot of times, let's back up just a touch. There was the big storytelling bubble. We've talked about that bursting. That's come up on the show a number of times. And in that, in kind of in the wreckage of that, there were a few shows that were specifically like essay driven. There were a few shows that were specifically like, we don't do notes. We don't do any of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then there was, you know, of course, the Moth hanging in there.
So
people that come to Chicago Storytelling Now kind of are like, is it, oh, so is it a competition thing? Like, is it a big, blah, 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 or is it one of those highly academic things? And it's like, no, it's kind of just people just telling stories. Like, it's a much more chill reading.
Yeah, it's performance. Right. I mean, you can use notes, you cannot use notes. And it's half features and half open micers. Yeah. And we really try and make it a space because our features are always people we know who are really awesome, who we've heard before or who have submitted if we haven't heard them. But we also try and keep it pretty chill because, you know, usually like open micers are just incredible and blow everyone away. But sometimes somebody's getting up for the first time and they're amazing. Sometimes somebody's getting up for the fifth time and it's not that amazing and they're working something out. And for me, it's really important to kind of create that space where people feel comfortable and nobody suddenly feels like they got shafted because they're like, well, I saw this one story that didn't really work out. And, you know, so I really try and couch those things and work it so that our audience is appreciative of folks and that nobody gets off the stage ever feeling anything less than excited that they had that experience.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I like the fact that, like, the two times I've done your show were the two times where I was like, I'm bringing stuff that nobody's heard. You know, like, just really doing hard stuff. Things that are a little more difficult because I felt comfortable doing it in your space, which is cool.
And that makes me really happy. Yeah, because that's really what we want. And I think even this time, we have this group of, we joke, we're like, oh my God, we are their post-college experience. So it's these guys who just graduated from college that showed up to one of the first story clubs I hosted.
Those cats that were all the way in
the back. Yeah, all the way in the back. They're awesome. It's Alana, Zach, AJ, Javier, like a bunch of guys. And they all just graduated from college and they're all buddies. They moved to Chicago. And they started coming, and I mean, maybe there have been like 1 or 2 months where, you know, we wouldn't see any of them, but pretty much exclusively from that time, they show up every single month. And so one of them had been at the show a few years ago that you had done, and he came up to me after this one. He goes, Is that the guy? Is that the guy who you saw us at the Green Mill? And I'm like, yeah, you can talk to him. And it's like, I thought it was so cool because I'm like, what was his life at that point, too? And you know, they're just awesome. And that's the thing that makes me really happy. I'm like, we're part of somebody else's story that when they're in their 40s and being like, what do we do with our lives and reminiscing about those days, that's going to be a thing that they reminisce about. Like when we used to show up to this crazy storytelling show and hopefully they'll still be showing up. But
and you touched on something I think is really important in that you were talking about Dana Norris was seeing a bunch of shows that she didn't like. So she was just kind of, and someone said, well, you should make your own show. And she did.
Yeah.
And I used to say that a lot to people when I was producing poetry shows, is people would come and they complain about, you know, your show doesn't have this and I wish it was this. You know, people would come and complain
about
the
shows.
Why didn't
you do it better?
Exactly. Like they would complain. And I go, well, I mean, people keep showing up. So apparently we're doing something right. Yeah. But I would say often, like, if you don't like the way I'm doing things, start your own show. And then it's like, well, it's privilege and that's not true. And not everybody can do that. I'm like, yeah, no, literally in this town, everyone can do a show. I fully believe that. Thoroughly believe that, like, people
assuming
can solve
their own
things.
Assuming you have the time. Ability,
oh, sure.
Right? Like that time. And it is. I mean, there are so many places that are willing to just let you show up and help out. I mean, we've hosted since, I think, 2014 or 2015, an Englewood open mic at Kusanya Cafe, which is one of my favorite cafes in the city. It's on 825 West 69th Street. So it's 69th and Green. And we just show up there every Saturday at 3. They close at 5. And it's whoever walks in the door. There are no features. There's no nothing.
Yep.
It's open mic. And we sort of open it up because some people want to come in and just sing or tell a story.
Yeah.
And again, we have like this one young guy who was a repeat performer. He would show up. He would sing songs. He would do poems. And then we didn't see him for a few weeks, and we found out that he had been a victim of gun violence. He had survived, but, and yeah, so it was, you know, we were trying to find him and reach out, and about 2 months later, we just see him, like, rolling up in a wheelchair, and he comes in, and he got very lucky. He actually, he had had to be in a wheelchair for several months, but he was going to be able to walk again, and he got up for the first time. He stood up, and we helped him just one step up on the stage. And he just sang this song to his son. And it was like, you know, we're all just, it's like Saturday afternoon, coffee shop, sweaty day. And, you know, we're all just sitting there like trying not to
lose it.
Because, you know, we've been worried about him for months. And then we, and just to see him come in and do that. And you're like, that's what these spaces do. You know, you can just show up and say something. And people actually want to hear what you have to say. It's why everybody watches reality TV obsessively. Mm. They just want to know how you're living.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's an important point as well, as it's, you know, those spaces exist for a reason. You know, it's really easy when you're on the more professional side of things, where you're like, I don't go to open mic. Like, I don't want to go to some open mic. I don't want to have to live. But like you go, I'm used to doing only features, or I'm only used to doing paid gigs or stuff like that. And you kind of go like, I don't want to go to an open mic. Like, why? Ugh, who cares? And it's like, because people need that.
Yep.
And there was a time when I was starting, and when you were starting, when we were all starting, that we needed like those kind of a little bit disorganized, less populous kind of shows that where you need to work some stuff out.
Yep. So, and it's great for me too. Like, I love working, you know, because somebody could say like, well, you've been doing this a while and it's, you know, just really loose open mic. But for me, it's like being able to work new stuff out, or things that I do feel like, oh, I'm not going to take this here yet. Like, I don't know what my angle is. I'm going to just do three little quick segments in my 7 minutes here. And I hosted with Angel Simmons, who is also, you know, an awesome storyteller. And we met because she was coming to the open mic when we first started hosting it. And then she came in as a host. And it's just, it's super great. And, you know, we love the cafe. There are buddies. Sure. And they told us, the owners were like, it's community owned. But the executive director and the folks who run it were like, you guys just keep showing up, and that's why we have storytelling. You know, and they're like, it's awesome because so many people plan events, and then they're like, yeah, we'll do this. And then
if there's no impetus for it, they don't feel like they have to stay.
Right. And they're like, but you just keep showing up. So now we've had storytelling for like 5 years, and it's and it makes me really, really happy that, you know, we get the opportunity to do that. And also, you know, you get to meet, let me see, your friends, neighbors, and fellow Chicagoans.
Look at you. You're such a liberal. but like in the good way, and I mean that in the best way possible, like you are actually a money where your mouth is type of progressive. like you've been all over the world and been farming and helping women pull things out of themselves. I'm sorry.
Did the FCC let you mention that?
Yeah, I don't care. Yes, we could tell that story. Real quickly, however long you like. How did that whole thing start for you? Because you've been, you lived in Africa, you lived in like all over the place.
Yeah, I think probably, without realizing it at the time, it was like having one very, very difficult parent made it really easy for me to be far away from home.
Okay.
For a long time. And, you know, and I say that, like, not realizing that at the time. I was just, you know, growing up in Scranton, Pennsylvania. That's how I felt, kid. I had, like, family in New York, and, you know, I'd go there, and I was just like, get me into a city. Get me out of here. And then, but also from a young age, I had family, you know, living in Israel that I was close with. So when I was 14, we went, and I ended up just staying there for the summer with my cousins.
Did they all speak English?
Yeah. Everybody spoke. I mean, in Israel, pretty much everybody speaks pretty solid English, too. I have some cousins, actually, who live up in the north who, amazingly, their English has gotten way, way, way worse.
Yeah. Did you grow up speaking Hebrew?
So,
like, you went to Hebrew school?
I went to Hebrew school. My parents don't speak any other languages, but I was always really into languages.
Sure.
So being there, so I knew some Hebrew when I got there, and I learned a lot more once I was there, and then, you know, in the ensuing years, going back and forth a lot more. But, you know, it was like I stayed there, and my family there was Orthodox, like super, super religious.
Oh.
Yeah, so interesting. But in the way of, like, they were also, like, money where your mouth is. So, like, their house just constantly had a bunch of random people, like somebody who had fallen on hard times and had been living out of a car and now was, like, sleeping in the upstairs bedroom and, you know, so and so. So it was also very open. And my cousin, who was my age, had just gotten kicked out of camp for talking about boys. About boys, not talking to boys. She talked about a boy. She was out, and we were so excited. So besides the fact that they were dragging her to a therapist every two nights, who would tell her, like, that's a big ouch, I remember, that's what he said. That's
big ouch.
Big ouch about anything she said. She was like, what's with this guy? But then she and I would just roam free on the streets like for weeks. And so hitchhiked for the first time at 14.
In Israel?
Yeah. It's a very like hitchhiking culture. Sure, they call it camping. Sure. And so it's a lot safe. I mean, you know, not always the best idea in the world, but like it's a lot safer than it was, you know, or at least that people perceived it as in the mm-hmm. States. So you would like hitchhike all over. We got caught in our first like bomb scare. We watched somebody like blow up a garbage can. It was, you know, so it was one of those things where all of a sudden I was like, I was this like, you know, pudgy kid in the suburbs. And I was like, oh, I don't really have like a lot of good friends. And my best friend lives far away. And,
sure.
And all of a sudden I was like, there's a whole other world. Like, and I think for me, that was very formative. And after that, I was like, oh, you can just always go away and do cool things and make really great connections. And you can always come back.
Sure.
And it kind of just took me through the rest of my life. I'm like, every place is always going to be there. It might be there very different, but it's still going to be there. And you can go away and you can do a thing. And you should ideally try and contribute and, you know, immerse yourself where you are if people want that. And then you can come back and, you know, and hang out with your family and force the people to hang out with you whether they want to or not, because that's your family and that's what they have to do.
So where did, excuse me. So Israel, mm-hmm. and then obviously came back to the States.
Yeah.
You went to college where?
I went to college at NYU, undergrad in the city.
Oh, excuse me.
Oh, is that a fancy one now?
NYU is a fancy school.
Okay.
It's a tough school.
Okay. No, it was, I mean, like, I think it was like, I guess it was like probably tough to get into. I don't know, but it's like, I always say the places you go, you know, you meet some of the most brilliant people you'll ever meet in your life and also some of the dumbest people you'll ever meet life.
Yeah.
And so it's just like, I'm like, it's NYU. Like, it was a great theater program, you mm-hmm. know, evil administration, awesome theater program, awesome teachers.
You
know,
you go
like
to Tisch?
So many places. Yeah, I went to Tisch.
Oh, see, look how like you're just, that's a big deal for a lot of people. Tisch is a big deal for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's a really great, like the Tisch programs and just what it allows you to do and explore, I think are really, really, really awesome. Yeah, I'm a fan.
No, it's good. You just got, you look uncomfortable for the first time.
No, you're looking at me
less.
Like,
you look uncomfortable for the first time I've ever seen. You're just like, is it okay?
Like,
people are noticing things.
No, you just looked so.
No,
so
I was
shocked.
Like, wait. I was like, wait. You went to Tisch, and you had a baby.
He let
like,
this
why?
Jerk
no, I'm kidding. So why would you just replicate? No. So you went to Tisch, ended up, and then you. How did you end up in Chicago?
So I went to Tisch, and then I had applied to grad school on a dare right after college. I was not intending to go to grad school. My roommate and I were going to move to Australia with $2,000 and just start like some theater company in Australia. And then I got into grad school and my dad was like, haha, like good luck. You just got out of college. Like nobody's paying for anything. And then somehow the program I got into had just gotten this grant where basically they're like, if you get into this program, we cover everything. So I was like, well, this is my shot to go to grad school.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to grad school. And then I moved back to the States by way of Pennsylvania and then back to New York. And eventually, bless you, kiddo.
Bless you.
I had always, like, thought Chicago was really awesome. And I'd done improv growing up, and I'd loved Chicago. And my partner at the time and I, after a couple of years in New York, were like, we think we want to go somewhere else. I was like, I've lived outside of the country, but I've never lived in another city in my own country.
Mm.
You know, and I was like, that seems, you know, like a thing that I would want to do and experience before I, you know, settle down in New York forever. And so we narrowed it down to about three cities. And we were like, okay, Chicago, San Francisco, Minneapolis. And we went to San Francisco, and we didn't know. We were just like, what places sound cool to live, you know?
What seems cold?
I think we looked
detached.
At like Austin too. Yeah, and we went to San Francisco for Burning Man, and we met all these like really weird, like self-righteous, racist hippies. And we were just like, okay, San Francisco's not our place.
Yeah.
But also like many amazing things about San Francisco. That was at the time we were just like, no. We went to Chicago, and we just had these ridiculous adventures and like ended up in some guy's like loft listening to like experimental jazz, and we're just like, we're moving to Chicago. That's
there it is.
And so, you know, one of my friends who I'd done improv with like years before, we had always said we'll move to Chicago together, and he had since passed away, and so it was also, I think, kind of felt like this extra thing for me that like I had this additional connection to Chicago. Like, you know, we always said we'd do this, and now he can't, and so let me try. And so we came here for 1 year, and we were going right back to New York.
Sure.
And then at the end of that year, we were like, ooh, we have a couple commitments, like, over the next 2 months, so I guess we'll renew our lease and stay a little longer. And And, you know, and the next year that happened too. And so I've been generally semi-home-based Chicago, Illinois, pretty much since the end of 2007. And so, you know, that partner is gone, but Chicago stayed. And so I worked abroad, came back to Chicago, managed a farm out in LaSalle County, which is great, Marseilles, Illinois, and came back to Chicago. So.
And so, yeah, so you're like, I've got this theater degree. I went to graduate school. Now I'm going to open all these urban farms. Like, how did that happen? I never understood that.
Yeah, that was, so that was another, so in, when I was still living in New York, I had ended up taking this job as director of teen programming at this like very progressive synagogue. So it was really all about, you know, leadership and doing not crappy things in the world. And I remember like early on, a couple of my students were looking for these study abroad programs and I was doing some research for them and I found this one and I was like, man, these all sound so cool. And I'm like, oh, I wish they had these things for adults. And I was, you know, like at the office late and I'm Googling it and I see this program in Israel on a permaculture farm. And I was like, well, that's super cool. That sounds amazing. And this was, you know, a little bit before we moved to Chicago. So let's say this is like 2005. And I'm like, that sounds awesome. I want to do it. And the program looked a little new. And I know as, you know, a little bit of a type A person, sometimes I'm extra critical when things are new. And I'm like, give it some time to get off the ground. I just started this job. You know, we have all these other things in life. And so I made myself a promise that night. And I'm like, in the next 10 years, if I'm still into it and this program is still around, I'm going to go do it.
Sure.
And so we moved to Chicago, 2007, 2010 rolled around. I was teaching at this awesome alternative school on the West Side, not too far from here.
Which one?
Westtown Academy.
I've been there.
Part of Greater Westtown.
I taught there.
Yeah, I think we talked about it. Yeah, so I taught math there for a few years. And I was like, 2010 rolled around, and I'm like, I made this promise to myself. Like, yeah. I literally had put it into, like, a calendar thing, like, in my email. And I was like, I made this promise to myself. So I check out the program. It's still there. It looks way cooler. You can get a permaculture certification. And I found some ways to actually get funding because, you know, there are many sketchy things about many billionaires. But every once in a while, they're like, if you go study in this place that we have some connection to, we'll find some way to make it free for you. So I talked to my principal there and she was like, you'll still have a job when you come back. And I went and I moved to this little permaculture farm and learned how to grow my own food and build systems for about 6 months. And during that time, I was like, I don't think I'm going to work inside again. I think I'm going to work outside forever. Wow. And then I would like sneak across the border to Lebanon. I built some urban farms
there. I would
just
sneak across the border to Lebanon.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds more dramatic than it is. It's really just administratively a pain because you can't enter in Lebanon if you've been in Israel. And then Israel likes to question you for 6 hours if you've ever been to Lebanon. Mm. So for Lebanon, you actually can't. I would have them not stamp my passport. And then it should be a 45-minute flight from Jerusalem to Beirut. But instead, you'd get on Jordan Air because Jordan knows that both their neighbors were being a little outlandish. Mm-hmm. You get on Jordan Air. You'd fly from Jerusalem to Amman. You would get off the plane. You would literally pick your suitcase up on one conveyor belt, place it on another conveyor belt. Someone would be with you. You would then get back on the next plane. They would go from Amman to Beirut and land in Beirut. And then just hope they didn't question you as to like why there was like a Jordanian stamp in your passport from like 10 seconds ago.
Yeah. That's wild.
Yeah. So
like,
I won't do it twice.
It's like, if I got to get off the Skyway, I'm not doing it. So
yeah,
you're a person of backbone.
It was definitely, I mean, and Beirut is just amazing. Like Lebanon, such an amazing country. And I had written this place called Saifi Urban Gardens and I was like, hey, do you have any jobs? You know, I'm going to be there. And they're like, we're called Saifi Urban Gardens, but we actually don't have any gardens. So do you want to come build some gardens? And I was like, done. And they're like, where's your certification from? Which was Israel. Obviously couldn't say that to like endanger them. So I was like, New Mexico. And they were like, cool. Nobody asked anything. Sure. So I was like, they have some permaculture stuff going on in New Mexico. That's awesome. So went there, ended up digging out this. Basically, it was it had been like a sort of like trash. Like, it hadn't been an actual full dump, but, like, sort of a minuscule dump from, like, during the Lebanese Civil War. And we dug it out, and I was, like, basically, like, don't grow food on it for 2 years, but we'll get all the stuff in order, you know. I had this awesome Syrian dude, Sirhan, who spoke no English, so I learned, and I was learning Arabic as part of my thing. So we communicated in my poor Arabic, except he knew the word doctor, because he would call me Dr. Shajara, which means Dr. Tree. Mm-hmm. And so Dr. Shajara, and he and I would just, like, work, you know, anytime that I wasn't in classes or, you know, doing a little fun Lebanese theater stuff, like, We were just digging out this garden and built
just
it.
Digging
and,
out.
Yeah, and I have two friends who like met. Yeah, just digging out.
You just let him dig it out.
Who like fell in love meeting at the garden years later, and I was like,
"What?"
Man. So you know, it's like left some blood, sweat, and tears in Lebanon.
That's pretty cool.
Would love to be back at some point. You know,
that's really cool.
Yeah.
Is it so? You'll have to excuse me for not understanding that part of the world as well as I probably should. But you couldn't go. You couldn't go to the Lebanon to build gardens and tell them that you were certified in Israel?
Because if you've ever been to Israel, you can't enter Lebanon. And I had been to Israel
that's the thing.
A
like,
lot.
I don't track that.
It's like there are places where if you have an Israeli stamp in your passport, they just won't let you in. And it's, you know, I mean, the thing is, like, the Israeli government, not a great thing.
You know, the
current Israeli government, very much
you
not
mean you
a great
don't agree
thing.
With everything yeah,
no,
that,
no.
As a Jew, you don't agree
yes.
with everything Israel's
I'm,
ever done?
I'm a self-hating.
That's, you must yeah, be self-hating. Must.
No, I mean, I think, you know, and I think when you live there, too, and when you have family there, it's like you see more realistically, you know, and I have, like, good Palestinian friends, good Israeli friends, and it's like it's what's on the ground is often very different than what you're hearing and what, you know, what the government is doing and trying to do. But it ends up, of course, only hurting the people. but yeah, so in Lebanon is one of the countries where if you have an Israeli stamp in your passport, you can't go in.
Mm.
So I would, we used to joke, so it's like there's a name that they refer to Israel as the territory in Lebanon. I think the word is like Kayan in Arabic. And so I used to joke with my friend who I was living with there because he knew, because we had known each other in the States. He had lived in Chicago for a couple of years, and we used to refer to it as the pepper. So mm-hmm. we were like, yeah, Cayenne. It's kind of like cayenne, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we would just be like, oh, yeah, yeah, blah, blah, when you're back at the pepper. and we were just like, this is cool. Nobody's going to figure out what we're talking about. Totally sick. Because, you know, you don't want to endanger your friends.
Of course.
And my friends who are Palestinians living in Lebanon, I actually never told them. And because it could be very dangerous for them
you
to be
you didn't tell them that
them.
You've been to Israel?
I didn't
or
tell
that
them
you're
that
Jewish
I was Jewish,
or,
that
oh,
I had
really?
Been to Israel, wow. that anything. Because just because I would never yeah. want to endanger them. And at that point, there was, you know, I mean, I was living there during the Arab Spring. So there was also just like, you know, positive upheaval in certain areas, but also like negative upheaval. And people were, you know, getting questioned and, you know, for like collaborating with this and that just on a small scale. So, you know, I just kind of kept it on the DL, and I look enough like everybody, you know, it's
yeah.
like that nobody really questions it. Everybody thinks I'm from next door. So it was like in Lebanon, they're like, you're from Syria. You know,
yeah,
when
right.
I was in Syria years ago, they're like, oh, from Jordan, you know, like, and so it just, you know, you can kind of blend and
yeah.
not make waves.
Yeah. I mean, I felt a real detachment from, I take a shot if you've heard this, but yeah. I had a real detachment from religion at a young age because I was
yeah.
raised Catholic and I just didn't get it. And I don't feel like it was, I don't feel like I was properly shepherded through it.
Yeah.
And you know what? Frankly, I'm glad because
yeah.
I was able,
oh, yeah.
I was given enough space to go like, I'm not buying any of this and I'm not in. not interested. No, thank
not
you.
In.
So around that time when I was, you know, young, when I was in my, you know, early adolescence-ish is when I started to kind of understand what the role that religion plays in the world and not
yeah.
historically, but actively, right?
Right.
So I didn't
like,
know.
Currently.
Exactly. So, I mean, like, what do you do? What do you do if you're me? Or how do you yourself, who's been all over the world and all that kind of stuff, like who kind of goes like, eh, you know what I'm not into? This whole religion thing. And then you kind of like I look at it. I'm rambling. I'm trying to be as diplomatic
no.
as possible. I'm saying I would look at that part of the world and go, see, this is only proof that religion is a bad thing.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say this. I think, you know, religion can be an issue, but there are a lot of other things that can mask themselves as
of
religion,
course.
Right?
Of
Which
course.
Is land needs, resource needs, just long historical trauma, long historical perceived trauma by another
mm-hmm.
specifically, you know, leaders who are interested in keeping people believing one thing because it keeps them rich and
yep.
in power. So
of course.
There are a lot of things, and it was interesting. You know, I tell this one story about my time in Lebanon where I talk about how, you know, when I was leaving the final time, I was like, oh my God, I've made these good friends. Like I've done this theater performance,
mm-hmm.
you know, and if we're going to be friends on the internet, they're probably going to find out some stuff. And so I'd rather it come from me,
sure.
except and very actively except to my Palestinian friends in Lebanon. Because Lebanon is also, I mean, people don't hear this much about it. And again, Lebanon and the Lebanese people are just amazing in so many ways. But in terms of the government, I mean, they have such restrictive laws against their Palestinian, you know, brethren who are there. There are only certain jobs that you're allowed to hold. Mm. Like one of my good friends was like, I have to keep teaching because I, you know, I wanted to go to school for was like he wanted to do like poetry and business or something like that, and there was like one thing that he, you know, was like, no, you can't do this, you have to do this thing. So there are actually job restrictions. And I'm not sure, you know, I'm not as up to speed on the laws right now, but at the time it was very clear, like you could see like these are the jobs you're allowed to hold, these are the jobs you're not allowed to hold, these are the things you're allowed to study for those jobs, these are the things no. But I was saying, I was like telling my friends who were Lebanese, like Christians or non-denominational, you know, just kind of letting them know. And I remember like telling my friends, like, I'm not actually going back to America. I'm going back to, you know, the Cayenne, like I'm going back to Israel. And I remember two of my friends were kind of like, you know, I don't know why they just hate us so much. Like, we would actually maybe like to be friends with Israelis. Like, we would love to see the place, and we would love to you know, do this and that. And I was like, no, you know, most Israelis I know say the exact same thing. And they were just like, no. And I'm like, yes. Yeah. And they're like, no. And they were just like, I just don't think they like us. And I'm like, that is also their perception. And I was like, and, you know, it was just one of those things where I was like, I wish there were some way, you know, to have everybody in a room, because it's like, you all like the same electronica and like the same foods and that, you know, and have this want of like, let's just, you know, both. And I think especially with Israeli and Lebanese cultures, like both cultures, very like warm, you know, family and food centered, you know, just like awesome art scenes in, you know, every direction. So it's one of those things where you're like, wow, you know, people, if you don't know, you don't know, right?
Of course.
So you believe, it's like, yeah, well, they hate us and they want to do this and they bomb us. And versus like, they're like, you're coming over here to like blow this thing up. And, you know, you hate us because you think we did this incursion because of the, and, you know, there have been historical mess ups on all the sides.
Oh, yeah. Yes, you're done. There's juice. There also, there's children's.
You ain't done. You just think you're done.
She just keeps like making eye contact with me. I'm keep moving my head, just like trying to keep her occupied. Yeah. Just like, oh. She's just like, I got you. Because from a distance, in baby eyes, just for the listener, both her father and I have prominent beards. So if you're a baby, you're like, oh, I could be my dad.
Yeah, why not? You're like,
close enough.
It's Pops and Glasses.
Pops and Glasses. Also, the name of my second album.
One I ever bought.
Second album I ever bought was Pops and Glasses.
Pops and Glasses.
And good.
But yeah, so I've always been fascinated by religion and always liked to be up on it. But also, you know, I mean, went through periods when I was exploring things, but it ended up just never being very religious. But I love tradition. I love culture. I love just immersing myself in. So when people will let you in, it's like, there's nothing better, right? They're like, they're sharing something that they value with you. Even if I'm like, ooh, this is not the way, you know, and having very religious family who I was very close with, I think also kind of taught me to navigate that world kind of early, just in any form of like, it's like what is perceived as respectful, or let me find the questions that are going to, you know, lead to positive conversation.
Sure.
And, you know, because I mean, again, like friends and family who are extreme on many sides of many issues, and just remembering to have your chill voice on and not be like, how could you think that, you know?
Right.
It's like when I had family recently, you know, before we watched his murder on live TV, who were saying like, Bloomberg is probably our only hope. And I was like, in my head, I wanted to be like, oh God, you know, as a New Yorker who lived under Bloomberg, as a, you know, human who reads things. And I was just like, no. And, you know, somebody who cares about money in the political system, et cetera. But I realized, I'm like, okay, well, that's not going to get across what I need to get across. So, you know, how do I have this conversation and say, oh, actually, like, you know, did you hear about these non-disclosure agreements? Mm-hmm. Did you, you know, and this and that. And you know, I don't always do it well. Like, sometimes I'm just like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
But when I have my wits about me and I'm not overtired or overstressed, you know, and I think that same way, it's like politics, religion, you know, sexuality, right? When I work in Uganda and people say some really interesting things about the LGBTQ community, and it's like, how do you have those conversations so that you can work with someone to sort of arrive at a more open view? So I admit, totally a gay proselytizer. But but you know, I think it's important. And it was interesting because I would see those conversations have, you know, over the like years that I would go back and forth, the people I had those conversations with, maybe it was just with me, but say, like taking this more open view, or even saying, like, you know, when somebody else would make a comment saying, like, oh, we don't talk that way, or like, you know, we're not like, oh, you know, people can do, even if it's just people can do what they want, you know, which is way better than everybody deserves to die. Right.
Right.
So,
I mean, but how do you broker that conversation if you're in Uganda, and which is, you know, a predominantly, I hate to be too judgmental, but it's a homophobic culture, if you will. Lots of it in this world. But that one, you know, that country specifically, I've heard about. You would know better than I. But like, how do you broach that subject when you just go like, oh, by the way, what you said is totally wrong.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I think it for me, it very much depends on if I know the person well or don't. I'll say that. So when it's like my, like the family that I am very, very close with in Uganda, you know, when it's with them, it's very different than, let's say, when I am talking with a pastor, you know, at a congregation where we're trying to, like, you know, get them to, like, listen to women speaking out about their experiences.
Yeah, sure.
And so one of the things that I found, so, like, in Uganda, it's like, people just, like, people have really, I mean, you don't want to generalize about any population, but people have really good sense of humor.
Sure.
And so it's like, if you can kind of, like, you know, be talking in this, like, light, fun way and kind of get a joke going or, like, a solid turn of phrase, it's like, I think people tend to welcome the conversation more, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Just because it's like, and I mean, there are a million things that I don't get in the conversation, but it's like, you know, I'd be like, ooh, that was, like, a great joke someone told. I don't like get it, but everybody else acknowledges it. And so one of the things that I would do is, now it's a little different, but when I started going there, there were, you know, the roads were just in really awful condition. There were new roads, you know, coming up, but there'd be these huge potholes, there'd be these whatever. So I would just say, you know, someone would bring up something like that. And so it would be like either the roads, and this would, again, depend on the person, or, you know, there were a lot of issues with, like, in villages, like child malnutrition. And so I would choose, it would either be the roads or malnutrition that I'd go, but I'd, you know, sort of say something like, well, for me, you know, if there's even one child who's hungry and somebody's worrying about what's going on in the bedroom between two adults, to me, I think they're worrying about the wrong thing. You know, what do you think? And usually people would be like, well, yeah, like, nobody wants a child to starve. Or if it was, you know, somebody, you know, like, on a more lighter note, it's like, well, like, you know, you look at what the roads are. If everybody's, like, losing their car and, you know, these big potholes on the road to, you know, Kampala, like, and we're worried about what two adults are doing in the privacy and everybody's okay with it, like, what are we, you know, what are we focusing on in our government? And they're like, yeah, they should be fixing the roads, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like, I mean, I think it's part of it is opening up that conversation in a safe space.
So,
you know, and
I'd love to talk about this further because I think that it, you know, as we can, this is obviously a predominantly left wing show. don't know if you've caught that, listeners, both of you. The
wow,
yes,
like
I agree. I too. See, tiny progressives.
Tiny progressive.
But what I mean is that as the world continues, specifically the United States, but as the world almost in a reactive way, in a classic definition of the reactionary way, has continued to lean more and more conservative, or at least conservatives, radical conservatives have felt more and more emboldened lately to say hateful things all over the world. And I think that's not just in America, but like speaking in the United States of America, as someone who has dealt with so many different cultures all over the world, sees so many different types of things. What's the solve there? Like, is it all education? Is it people learning about comparative religions? Is it everyone should have to live with an immigrant for 6 months so you realize they're not on fire? Like, what is it, you know, like, what's the move?
Yeah. I mean, I do think that, and there's no substitute for, you know, I mean, you look at like when the Supreme Court was ruling on marriage and how society had changed, right? Like when they were ruling on gay marriage and people started talking about like, well, now so many people are more in favor of it. And part of it is because they knew somebody who would come out or knew somebody who knew somebody who would come out, right? And so I will say like just across the board before we even go into like conversations, you know, there's no substitute for experience, right?
Of course.
That's the ultimate education. There's no substitute for experience where you care enough about somebody that you don't want them to hurt that you're like, maybe this thing over here is actually not fair to them and they're being hurt because of that and then that thing came out of my mouth. I want that thing to stop coming out of my mouth,
right?
So no substitute for that, but I also think, you know, it's, and again, I'm not always great at this, but making it safe for people to like unpack their messed up thoughts for all of us, like, and even our not messed up thoughts, but in those, you know, to me it's like if you're taking someone else's rights away in any way or not recognizing, you know, racial disparity or gender disparity or like, you know, issues of like trans people and trans people of color being murdered, like, you know, excessive rates compared to the general like population, the broader population. It's like you want to make it safe for people to say their outlandish stuff for a little bit,
yeah,
not around somebody who they could hurt.
Sure.
So it's like if you're somebody who, you know, it's like I might be hurt that somebody I know thinks that thing, but I'm like, they're not going to wound me the same way, you know, one of my trans friends of color would have to like be having that conversation,
right,
and hear what somebody thought of them, right?
So I get that.
So I think that is part of it, and I think that is education. I also think, I mean, for me, I think that the whole 45 presidency, right, is the biggest show of failure of education.
Agreed.
In the United States, and there are a lot of other things, right? There's also failure of our healthcare system,
right,
of, you know, markets, of all of it, like, for all people, and those all lead to it, right? People tend to... Bless you, bud.
Bless you.
People tend to, quote-unquote, hate immigrants more when, you know, when they feel like they have had something to lose, right? When they feel like they haven't gotten something and somebody else is getting this
right,
thing.
Right, right, right.
And that's somebody else who doesn't deserve it because I was born here.
Exactly.
Right? And so, and part of that is also education, right? Is knowing, like, what are you getting? You know, what are these jobs? What are you entitled to that you're not getting that has absolutely nothing to do with somebody who is seeking asylum,
of course,
right? Which is a totally legal thing. Why do you not know that asylum is legal? Okay, like, you know, I mean, it's a lot. And so, you know, my hopefully my partner will forgive me for sharing this, but he has some relatives who are, you know, very problematically conservative. And for him, he's just like, enough, like, just stop talking. And for me, I always try and like, I'm like, well, let's let them, you know, before our kid totally is fluent in English, like, let's let them say the crazy thing. And then let's process through that. And sometimes you're back to square one. But I will say his brother now says, like, he'll tell a story and then he'll be like, oh, I didn't need to just throw in that person's race right there, did I? And I'm like,
no,
you didn't. And but it's like, and you know, Joe is like, he only says that when he's around you. And I'm like, yeah, but he knows enough now to say it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's slow change, but you have to kind of, to me, I think you have to leave space for someone to change.
Sure.
I sound really patient right now because I'm not having to do it. You know, sometimes when I have to do
absolutely
it, I'm like, God, take your space somewhere else.
Well, that's why I'd say to a lot of people, like, I'm the best version of myself at this
right
desk.
Oh, yeah.
When I'm very
yeah
considerate of the things that are coming out of my mouth because I'm at this desk and I understand people are listening to it, I am very impatient and not like I was just writing about empathy right before you got here.
Really?
I was writing about empathy, and because it's something that these young folks that I'm corresponding with that are students, whatever, long story, basically they're talking about empathy in their class, and they're meeting with they're corresponding with other adults around the country. Just, you know, it's called the Diversity Dialogue Project.
Oh, cool.
That a friend of mine started, and I'm a part of it, right? And I'm really happy to be a part of it, and it's a very cool thing. But because of that, they're talking about empathy and what that is. So I was just thinking about it and writing about it, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's coming up, and then I realized that, like, I'm a real wise, patient MF-er at this desk, right? I go out in the world. You put me in traffic, I am not a nice guy.
Yeah, this is, and you know, it's funny, traffic has been coming up a lot because I realize the place where I speak the most poorly to and about other humans is when I'm driving.
Me too.
And it is only to the humans that are driving. I'm going to switch out this kiddo's food.
Hey.
And so I realize, I'm like, ooh, without even realizing it.
No, there's two. There's
there
number
go
one. There we go.
That it, without even realizing it, you know, I'm kind of saying these things that I don't want to be, not the best version
yep
of myself.
Right.
And so I was talking to my best friend who you know is has the like the non-medical type of doctorate in like how brains work and process things and I was telling her what I was kind of thinking of saying, and that I was like, I'm trying to change my language so that I say, this is gonna sound like the most like liberal crap, but I think you'll hopefully get
yeah
it, that, you know, I'll be like, oh, that person just forgot how to be thoughtful right now. And part of it is modeling that for, because I was like, I want it to be language that we can also use around, you know, like having older relatives who deal with like mental illness, and also, you know, like racism and extreme conservatism, which is also maybe a mental illness, you know, like thinking that other people don't deserve the same things you do, but like, you know, who have, you know, more diagnosed mental illness and different issues that kind of can come out and make them say things that are really not okay. And to allow for that repair so that we're not like, you know, to her, you know, this person is an awful person. Like, you're, you know, you're so-and-so, like, your great-uncle said this thing and it's awful.
Sure,
or, like,
sure,
your grandma said whatever. So that we can say, like, oh, they forgot to be thoughtful. So that, you know, like, you can forget to be thoughtful and then we can make that better.
Mm.
You know, they didn't put the work in, and if you put the work in, you won't sound like that. And that's
sure.
Like that's what I'm thinking. I'm like, what's an age appropriate way and thing that I'm trying to reteach myself to say? And my best friend was like, oh yeah, I think that allows for some good change. Because at first I was like, what I really just want to say is like, that's a terrible person. Don't be like that terrible person, which yeah. is not helpful. Like right. that doesn't actually teach her a thing. It teaches her that like she's going to be judged if she has those views and. Mm. You know, and I'm like, you will be, but I hope I'm going to still love you yeah. and we'll process through them and I'll send you to a re-education camp. It'll be great.
Yeah, yeah. Good. You know, just conversion therapy.
Yeah, you're like, that's okay. Just like, please don't rebel by being like, people are on welfare because they deserve it and don't want to work. Like,
yeah, right.
the worst rebellion in our home.
Well, and that's what I keep saying is like, I say this to all my friends. I'm like, yeah, you hardcore, like canvas tote parents. Hanging out with your conscientious children. I'm like, they're going to become cheerleaders and young Republicans just to piss you off.
Hey, cheerleading is a sport, and it's totally fine.
You're right. Excuse me for minimizing and referring to cheerleading in the classical sense of the word.
Are you done, kid?
No way.
Bah, I don't
You're
believe
not
it.
Done.
I don't believe it.
I don't buy it.
But yeah, I mean, I joked when we were pregnant that I was just trying to figure out ways to make sure that our kid, our future kid or kids wouldn't rebel in that way. And I was like, well, every time there's a treat that's missing, I'm just going to say, you know, Mitch McConnell and the Republicans took that out of the fridge and they didn't care enough to put it back, you know, so then
What's wrong with you?
I was just like, how can we really get it in there so that that rebellion will not happen?
You could do that, or you could pay attention to your child and, like, you know, create a dialogue of here's decency at
I
a
mean,
young age.
Of course, yeah, but why know, can't we do the two in concert?
Of course, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, and I think that's important. Like, I think if you pay attention to your kids and like if you kind of teach them from a young age, like, hey, there are other religions in the world and there are other types of humans in the world and you know like that stuff goes a really long way. Like I didn't know a non-Christian until
really?
I was like I think the first time I had a conversation about Judaism I was like 19-20 years old.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, Illinois.
It was also just kind of who I was exposed to, you know? Like I knew there were people. I knew there were kids whose parents were Indian immigrants and Pakistani immigrants. I knew that there were Jewish people in the world. Like it's not like I was complete. I was ignorant.
Right, you didn't
to
know
it.
That they didn't exist.
But there was a real lack of experience and a lack of understanding and a lot of things that I just wasn't taught as a kid. I just it was never brought to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's I think that that's true for most people, for better or worse, right? Like in a variety of ways. I mean. I think about it, but it's like on the, you know, when you're part of any form of minority, I was like, I definitely remember in third grade, you know, Brian Szymanski being like, all Jews go to hell. Ooh. And I was like, well, is he going to get in trouble for at least saying the H word, you know? And, you know, and he did, but they were like, well, that's what he's been taught. And I was just like, what?
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was an early lesson and like, oh, that's what, you know, his religion believes or what they tell kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, and realizing, like, well, if the adults who should do something aren't going to do anything about it, how can I do something about it that doesn't involve punching him in the face because then I get in trouble?
Right.
You know, so I think, and I do think, yeah, I mean, I think you're right, though, that I definitely, you know, have many friends who are like, yeah, I just never met somebody outside of my own circle. Or, you know, when I lived in Ireland, people would always be like, Ireland isn't racist. And you're like, that's literally because, like, you'll live in these communities where everybody's known each other forever. And then it's, like, as soon as, like, somebody who does not look like you or who is not, you know, like, Turkish, like, immigrants come. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, like, oh, we're very surprised. Ireland's actually a little bit racist, you know?
You don't know.
And again, obviously, that's the country is not a monolith. But it was something you would just hear all the time. And it was right before, you know, two large immigration waves came in. And all of a sudden, there was this thing that people had to sort of reckon with because they were like, well, we weren't racist when like we had friends with dark hair and red hair. Mm-hmm. But like now when it's like people look different in terms of their skin or in terms of their accents, that's not like County Derry versus County Cork.
Right.
You know, it's a different thing to actually be exposed to and understand.
Absolutely. Right? I know. I agree too. That's so, it's just, I don't know. It's just wild. I think that there's a, there is a certain of like tolerance of intolerance sort of thing. It's like, well, that's their religion. And I go, well, I mean, for me, I think any religion that, that treats women as a second class citizen, your religion is bullshit.
Yeah.
Personally, I just think, full stop, that's just how I feel about it. So it's like, but then a lot of people would be like, that's intolerant of me to say.
Yeah, but it's like, I think it's not, you know, it's, I mean, I'm going to, you know, mess up all of the versions of the quote, but it's like where, you know, it's like, you know, tolerant of your rights up until the point when they interfere with my right to live or exist, right? And looking at that, and so I think, I know, rights are important. I'm going to put this cap on. Bah. But it's cool, bub. It's
she needs to get out?
Probably in a second. I'm going to come. But yeah, looking at, you know, what you, you know, what you want to be tolerant of every religion, but you also want to understand what are the parts of those. Like, these are ancient things, and it's people interpreting them, and you have options as to how to interpret it, right?
Sure.
And you don't have to interpret it that somebody is a second-class citizen, because, you know, there are other things that, like, you probably wear, you know, wool and linen together, and you're cool with that, and we've allowed that, like, and that was, like, way big deal. You know, only happened once a year, Holy of Holies, and then, like, could never happen again at, throughout the entire year by anyone who wasn't the high priest.
Sure.
So it's like, if then you're saying, like, and, oh, but a woman is subservient to her husband. Well, like, yeah, that's, like, buried amongst a bunch of things about, like, not eating a jellyfish. So, like, let's just...
Well, you shouldn't, have eaten jellyfish at a time, because there was a time when eating a jellyfish was a dangerous thing.
Right, yeah, and and you know, in the culture at that point, maybe there was XYZ understanding, or maybe it was an aggrieved dude who actually edited this portion of
You don't say. You don't say. But, you mean the people who wrote them, who wrote the books had their own influence in the book?
Sometimes.
They weren't just actively reporting? Oh, okay, good.
Sometimes an aggrieved dude.
Yo, have we been... We've been talking for a million years. Did you just realize this? Yeah. I just looked at the clock and I was oh my God, it's after two.
What? We can talk.
How? We can talk. I could talk to you all day, obviously. So, but unfortunately, we have to wrap it up because, like, I actually have a life outside of here. I just didn't even look.
Do things in the
world. Because we
had 2:11.
We had daylight savings, and no one updated the clock that's above. No one updated the control desk clock. So I'm looking at it going, oh, it's only 1 o'clock. I'm going to run. And I went, oh, scheisse. I can curse in German. Yo, will you tell us about anything you're working on right now?
What's up right now? I mean, the organization that I work for, Greater West Hound Community Development Project, which runs the alternative high school and an adult job training program, is always working on bettering and making more accessible all of the resources in the West Hound community, Humboldt Park, Austin, you know, North Lawndale. And so anyone who is looking for job training in manufacturing or shipping and receiving can come by 500 North Sacramento.
And it doesn't have to just be you. You can refer people.
Yeah,
as
you
well.
Can refer people. It's not just about you. It's someone you know. Same for someone who has either, if you know someone who has dropped out or been kicked out of a Chicago public school, we have a high school available for them. So, yeah, you know, that's something that I'm always working on and is very dear to my heart. And then Story Club Northside is April 2nd at Hungry Brain over
Northside.
Yay,
the lovely Hungry Brain.
It's awesome. On on Belmont, just a little bit east of Western. Our Kusanya open mic is this Saturday, March 14th, second Saturdays of every month. And I host The Moth up in Evanston and sometimes at Lincoln Hall. And so if you go on themoth.com, there are tons of Moth shows around Chicago. It's pretty awesome. And Story Club Southside at Bernice's in Bridgeport is on the 16th.
Oh, Bernice's.
March 16th. I know. It's
great. I've had some evenings at Bernice's.
Oh, I believe it. Bernice's is a magical place.
It is a real magical
place. But yeah, those are mainly the things I'm working on. And yeah.
Hey, well, it's good to see you.
You too.
Even though, like, I thought you lived on the moon, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, yeah, you still exist. And with a baby. You have a baby now? And when did this happen?
I exist twice now.
Yeah. Ooh.
Yeah.
I replicated. Yeah. Awesome. Well, you, of course, if you want to, where's the best, are you on the internets? Can we find you specifically?
Yeah, you can find me. My brother made me a Facebook page that's Stephanie Douglas. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
She's saying we need to update stuff, which we do. It's Stephanie Douglas, and I think it's like Stephanie Douglas Storyteller, something like that. So that's probably the easiest way to find it. I need to get on it. But my brother's really sweet, and he made me this page. Good. So, you know, I appreciate it.
Well, it's good to see you, Steph. I appreciate it.
You too. And I appreciate you.
You know what? I like it when people are nice to me. Now I'm going to cut off your mic so you can't say anything else. All right, good. You can listen to Boston Mouth on Q4 Radio, QUE4.org. Shots! Streaming around the world every single Monday from 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. Lots of different things coming up all over the place, and lots of different things happening here at Q4. Please check us out, QUE4.org. RG. Hope you're having a good day and that things are going well for you. Apologize for being for vague booking earlier, but I've got some, I may have some new things to say to you on the horizon, and those things are coming. But right now, let's get some Billy Bragg and Will Carlos, California Stars, digging this tune, and I'm digging you. Have a good week. I like to rest my head.